Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer, better man of the world because he didn't have to go through certain things, I guess. I don't know, Williams. It's really difficult to kind of come up with something off of the movie that we're about to review.
Yeah, it's probably best that you didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Also with us is intern slash part-timer slash stenographer slash coffee bringer who brought coffee a couple times.
And then I brought tea.
And then she brought tea. Amy.
And cocoa. Yes, it's me. I still brought cocoa.
Wait, when did she bring cocoa? Oh, that was like one time, wasn't it? From Starbucks?
No.
I do remember this.
It was so long ago, we don't even recall.
Yeah.
We got a great show in store as we're going to be talking about one of the most talked about films from 2023 that is in the race for winning all the awards, and that is Poor Things. So stick around as we dive into that, and just a heads up, this is going to get a little explicit because of the content of this conversation, so be warned, the episode will be marked as such, but we're letting you know verbally as well. There will be explicit content we will be talking about, but before we get into the explicit content, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Thursday.
Wednesday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday.
I don't know what's happening.
Something.
On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101 and threads.
And threads, yes.
Threads, you did it.
We got a website, and it's filmlosophers.com. There you can catch almost, allegedly, 300 episodes. Everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrillers. There's probably a first for us on talking about movies like this. But if you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also catch us wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Give us a look or a follow or a subscribe at The Filmlosophers. Listen to what we got to say. Give us a comment in the title section below and give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes,
indeed. We'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. We're gonna dive into this movie, but I feel like we kind of have to balance this conversation out because it's going to get really interesting about this film. Not that it's a bad film, I'm not saying that, but the content that we'll be talking about will be probably NSFW for the younger audiences out there. But I did want to talk about something on the other side of the spectrum, and that is, who is giving Sesame Street characters access to social media?
Their dad.
Okay, honestly, Elmo is 3 and a half. That is again. Under 13.
Again. And again.
Yeah, but like under 13, he should not be on
Twitter. Twitter at all. Does he know what goes on Twitter? Like, I would love to go and see like what...
I feel like he does now.
I also like that he mentioned that it was Twitter and then he had to backtrack and say that it was X. And I was like, thank you.
Oh yeah, because that's totally the focus of this conversation.
Yes, it is.
Anyway, the fact that Elmo went on Twitter... And mind you, we'll always call it Twitter. There's no way in the world I'm going to call it X. There's no way I'm going to call anything unless it is specifically titled with an X, X. So like Exhibit, X-Pac, Triple X, and I'm talking about the movie franchise, not the or the other, whatever. Anyway, unless it's specifically titled that from the get-go, I'm not going to. But anyway, apparently Elmo on Twitter blew up the entire world and made everybody... pretty much gush their emotions on the platform.
They trauma dumped
because apparently Elmo a couple days ago, according to Today while we're recording, went onto Twitter and posted, how are you all friends doing? Something to that effect, asking for...
He's checking in.
Yeah, he's checking in with quote-unquote friends. Needless to say, much like the Steve debacle from Blue's Clues coming back onto social media and bringing everybody into their feels for a good season, everybody kind of trauma dumped onto poor Elmo and literally let him have everything. I mean, we were looking at stuff. We were looking at responses from everything from "It's a Monday," "I, you know, hate Mondays," blah blah blah, to "I am having a quarter life crisis and I can't get through my schooling," and blah blah blah. And what are we doing here? I get it. Yes, Elmo is a beloved character from a kid's show that most of us grew up watching to some extent. However, he is a puppet, guys. He doesn't, there is no 3.5-year-old who is reading these things. There is a grown man who is looking at all these tweets and saying, I don't know how
listen, gonna... ever since Rockgate, like, Elmo has just been like on the up and up.
Oh my god, Rockgate. Rocco ain't coming back on that one.
Oh man. I just, look, here's the thing. Whether or not, I mean, mind you, okay, yes, these wholesome, joyful moments of, you know, having somebody kind of be the catalyst to create an opportunity to have a conversation about emotional well-being, that's great and all. But to the extent that you are, as Amy so eloquently put, trauma dumping onto a 3.5-year-old fictitious character, if you're so willing to put that out there for Elmo, why don't you just put that out there to begin with? Like, if you're reaching out for a handout, just don't do it on a kid's character.
Okay, but like, some of them weren't even real though. Like,
were they?
No, some of them were fake and
who
were funny.
Oh, you mean the responses?
Yes.
Oh, well, yeah, but yeah. I mean, out of the 40,000 plus responses, I'm pretty sure some of them were really hoping that, you know, Elmo showed up at their house and be like, "It's going to be okay. Elmo like you." Whatever. Okay,
that wasn't bad, by the way,
was
right
not.
Now.
I wasn't even trying.
We were really kind of impressed.
I was like, how did you pull that out? but yeah, like, when people are like retweeting him and being like, "It's going poorly. You don't have a mortgage, do you, Elmo?" Like, I'm not gonna take that seriously.
I mean, though, that's probably hard. I mean, it's Twitter. Yeah, I feel
it's
like
Twitter. I feel like you and I have very different opinions on Twitter.
Yeah, I work on like social media. I'm in marketing, so
yeah, I come across everything's fake or an ad. So
yeah, you tell that to the countless hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who just are using Twitter for very evil deeds. I just, it's one of those things where it's like, number one, it's okay to put out things like that from the perspective of a character. It's another thing to create a call to action where you're literally going to get everything out of the woodwork from people. And like I said, I'm of the mind, yes, it's a great thing to create the conversation. It really is. However, I feel like moving into that realm of things that should kind of be, I don't know how to respond to that. Like, I don't know. Ames, you've been quiet this entire time. Are you doing more taxes? Are you doing more paperwork?
No.
She's over here paying bills.
I did my taxes already. Good. They're job. Already turned into the IRS. Gummy.
No, she didn't, Spencer. She's running from the law. Go ahead.
No, I'm not. What I was actually going to say was, I was doing a little bit of research because we talked about who was letting Elmo onto the internet at 3.5. Hmm. It actually turns out that the social media manager for Elmo's account is a 25-year-old from New Jersey.
Oh, this makes a lot more sense.
And she was responsible for Elmo and Rocco. Okay. And so this was her just being honest about checking in with people, and she didn't expect what was coming up. But simultaneously, I do agree with Spencer on some of them where they're like, I know someone's like, "Everything's burning down around us, Elmo." And I'm like, okay, maybe. But then some of them are like really bad and mean, and other people are just looking for the comfort and the solace of somebody from their childhood still cares enough to check in, and that even if it's Elmo and everybody who's grown and listening to this podcast does understand that Elmo is a Muppet, but also what he creates in us, and what he harkens back to, that opportunity of belief and that things will be okay. And it's very much Steve and Blue's Clues. So
I don't know, because it's like with Steve,
you didn't
and Blues,
trauma dump on him, and I didn't either. With Spencer
Steve,
did it,
but with Steve from Blue's Clues, it was more of like a personal connection, not so much personal. I mean, personal as in like a real person responding or creating, because it was that TikTok that he did where he's like, "Hey, how are you doing? Yeah,
and he apologized too.
But it was like somebody. It was like the voice of somebody that you knew, and you could see the face. It was an actual human being. I don't know. I'm not trying to like dismay any Elmo fans out there. And in fact, if anyone is listening, we do have a friend, actually, who is married to former co-host Chad, who is absolutely
terrified
of Elmo.
He sent me the video and I was like, what are you doing? And she's cowering in a corner.
So without saying any names, because we're not going to put anybody on blast, but I know that for her, I know this is probably something that she's cheering for vehemently in the background, like, yes, yes. But it's just one of those things where it's like you create a character that is definitively for a show, but I don't know. I get a little tossed in the weeds when it comes to incorporating things like that into real life, posing real life questions that are going to get real life answers. Like, what is the purpose behind it other than to create a media frenzy?
Well, and also I think it comes to the question of when brands, because Elmo, like it or not, is a brand in and of himself. Part of the machine. When you make those questions, you are looking to start conversations, and what those conversations turn into can both hinder and hurt your brand. Mm. And when it comes to Elmo putting that out there, and I don't think the social media manager for Elmo's account expected people to be quite as earnest as they are. But even that they're getting tweetbacks from Oreo and Sour Patch Kids
and the Garfield movie Twitter account and the President of the United States.
Just, like, most of those people are just piling on.
Dionne Warwick responded, Spencer.
Oh, yeah,
T-Pain.
I saw that.
And T-Pain. Yeah,
well, T-Pain's ultimately a fictional character as well. Let's just be honest.
He and his wife don't think they're fictional characters.
Well, of course, fictional characters don't think they're fictional.
And probably in similar fashion about what the rest of the conversation we're going to be talking about tonight, we're not going to talk about T-Pain's marriage, because that's a whole conversation in itself. Don't you know that T-Pain's come out and said several times that the only reason why his marriage is so successful is because they have an open marriage?
Oh, didn't know that.
Yeah. I don't know who this is.
T-Pain? Mr. What do you call it? What is that?
It was not the voice box. He was Auto-Tune.
Auto-Tune, yeah. Mm. The rapper who does Auto-Tune. Mm.
He likes the bartender.
I don't know.
We're going to play music for Spencer.
Yeah, we're going to have to play music for Spencer. But anyway, I just, you know what? If you have a fictional character who is somebody who has been a longstanding icon for a lot of people, I don't know if you want to put them in the limelight for young children to then begin to start researching things like mental illness and mortgage failure and, you know, quarter life crises and things like that.
All I feel like child is researching mortgage failure.
How do you know?
Because
you
the
pause,
second that they do it, they're going to get a long explanation that they're not going to read and they're just going to leave.
I kind of agree with that one.
I don't know. But either way, it is what it is. As a marketing manager, I have to kind of protest against this. But
pause and protest?
Yeah. So.
Well, you know, don't know how long we've been in the marketing game. This could have been like,
she's 25 too also, so just looking at the kind of people that are coming up now, you start, you know, mental health and emotional awareness and being kind and all, we're getting to all these things that they're like, hey, we're gonna check in, and all of us millennials are like, it's not good.
Well, speaking of checking in, let's go ahead and dive into our conversation of the evening. As we talk about one of probably the most
interesting
films that people have been bringing up, and that is Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things. This movie has been, interestingly enough, talked about in all the award circles. It's been brought up. It's actually won several. So we felt it was necessary for us to go and watch this, and we experienced it. Yeah. So before we move forward, Spencer, give us that official synopsis goodness.
Bella Baxter is a young woman brought back to life by the brilliant and unorthodox scientist Dr. Godwin Baxter. Under Baxter's protection, Bella is eager to learn. Hungry for the worldliness she is lacking, Bella runs off with Duncan Wedderburn, a slick, debauchered lawyer, on a whirlwind adventure across the continents. Free from the prejudices of her time, Bella grows steadfast in her purpose to stand for equality and liberation.
Liberation. Directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, written by Tony McNamara, and produced by Lanthimos and lead actress Emma Stone, the film also stars Mark Ruffalo, Willem Dafoe, Rami Youssef, Christopher Abbott, and Jared Carmichael. and mind you, this is actually a song in a part of the score for...
We're not just playing random things, we swear. Mm-hmm. It's actually in there.
Yeah. A couple of key pieces about the film. Yorgos Lanthimos first approached Alice Derek Gray about adapting Poor Things back in 2009. Unfortunately, the author did pass away before Lanthimos could actually finish the film, so he never got to see it come to fruition. But this would also mark the director's first adaptation of a novel. Another fun piece of information, Mark Ruffalo was actually initially hesitant about the role of Duncan Wedderburn after first reading the Poor Things script, penned by Tony McNamara. He said to the director, "I don't think I'm right for this," Ruffalo said, and the director just laughed at him and said, "It's you." You know, it's like Mark Ruffalo, whom for the longest time a lot of us can attribute his on-screen appearances as usually the big green guy, Bruce Banner, the Hulk. So seeing him stretch out and having the opportunity to do it in such a unique piece, I can definitely see where Mark Ruffalo's hesitancy came from, as we'll go further into detail. Another key piece of information about the film, during a press conference at the 2023 Venice Film Festival, the director commended star Emma Stone on fully committing to filming her very graphic sex scenes in the movie. He went at length saying things to the effect that her ability to be bold and her ability to be not just bold, but also willing to take on and fully embody the character was very commendable. And he was actually surprised to see how much she was willing to say, "Oh, this is something that Bella would do, so we have to do it." So that says a lot. After seeing the film, for the sake of what this film is all about, I don't think I've seen that much of Emma Stone's skin
ever.
So as I stated, this is going to be an explicit conversation, not so much for the language, but the content that we'll be talking about. So again, if you are, easily offended by conversations about things like this of this nature, this episode probably isn't for you, and we got about 300, allegedly 300 plus more that you can go ahead and choose from to listen to. So diving in, and of course we're going to be talking about spoiler alerts because of the fact that, number one, this is on the awards docket for the Oscars. It's, like I said, it's won several other awards, and everybody seems to be talking about it. So spoiler alert, we'll be talking about everything in this movie. You've been warned. Let's talk expectations. Rolling into this thing, I can already see Spencer cringing as we head into this conversation. What were some of your guys' expectations pertaining to this movie? Because I personally didn't know it was based on a novel prior to watching it, or else I probably would have tried to make an attempt to read the book. So I'm more than likely going to assume that you guys didn't know this was based on a book either.
Nope.
No.
Okay. Well, let's
we're in that boat together. Woo.
Ames, let's start with you. Did you see the trailers for this movie?
I think I saw teasers where it was literally like Emma Stone futuristic moment, kind of looks like it could be like spacey sci-fi, and then it would just flash the title, and that was it.
It's like a Barbarella kind of thing.
But I just remember seeing, because it was on a YouTube, it was between YouTube videos.
YouTube ads.
It's YouTube.
It'll but do it.
It was literally like the 15 seconds. And so other than I knew it was Emma Stone and I assumed it might be sci-fi, I had no expectations going into this movie, like whatsoever.
What about you, Spence?
Okay.
Oh boy.
The eyebrow rub, is gonna happen.
Okay, so I didn't see
what people aren't able to see right now is how much Spencer is like constantly rubbing his eyebrow and like he's just so nervous.
No,
about
because this verse is embarrassing, but I had to talk about it because it's hilarious too.
Okay,
so I saw the poster, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay,
the poster with Stone's face on it, right?
Yeah. Okay,
yeah,
is that the one where like she has two different colored eyebrows or something? Or?
Yeah, and so I looked at this, right? And I'm like, who is this actress?
I love it. Let's go.
Like, I didn't bother to look it up for like a week, like until like right before the movie. I'm like, that's not Emma Stone.
So, she's got caterpillars on her eyebrows. Yeah. That's it?
Yeah.
That
is it. Because like this wasn't on our list originally, and then it just suddenly was. So I did even less research than normal.
Well, we had a little bit of trouble with scheduling, and so we had
also
to fill.
Because a movie was not in our area.
Well, that not too. At all.
Yeah.
Look. I think
it's still not.
It's not coming until like February or something.
Oh.
Which one are we talking about?
Sometimes I think about dying.
Oh, yeah. We had another film on the list, and apparently we didn't check with the local theaters to see if it was going to be playing. My expectation for this film, honestly, knowing. So I'm familiar with Yorgos Lanthimos' work. I've seen maybe one or two of his films. I'm not fully like fluent in a lot of his movies, but I saw The Killing of a Sacred Deer and The Lobster. Which
I saw The Favorite.
And that's one of the ones that you saw.
Yeah, that's the only one I saw. Oops. Which had Emma Stone in it Olivia Colman. So I was in a for Olivia Colman, I'm not going to lie.
But after watching movies like The Killing of a Sacred Deer, specifically mostly The Lobster. The Lobster is one that sticks with me the most because I've seen it the most from him. I assumed that it was going to be morally... it was going to be giving questions of morality within the characters and decision making that had to pretty much deal with people's direction of their life. If you're not familiar with The Lobster starring Colin Farrell and Rachel Weisz as well as John C. Reilly, essentially is about a society where people who are having trouble finding mates, finding, you know, someone to marry. They go to this organization, this kind of like camp, if you will, this retreat at this big facility where essentially they are told that they will do everything within their power to help that person find a mate within their organization. And if not, that by the end of the term, if they were unable to find someone, then they will turn them into an animal to live out the rest of their days. And Colin Farrell goes in at the very beginning and he tells them that he wants to be turned into a lobster if he doesn't find a mate. And it goes really, really awry from the get-go. And the movie ends on a very interesting note where you don't really know how it actually ends. But you know that either way, the way the choices were going to go, it was not going to be good. Knowing that information, the only thing I could gather from this was that it was going to be really... really, really taxing on my mental acrobatics of understanding where the characters are coming from. But other than that, I saw a trailer between YouTube videos and an ad, and I saw the same poster that Spencer saw. So that was it. And even then, you don't really get that much of a grand idea of the movie outside of what people I know who have seen it, their like brief thoughts on social media and whatnot. So with that said... So first impressions right out the gate, movie is over and you've stepped out of the theater. Spencer, what was your first thoughts? Oh, you're going to give an Amy response.
Well, okay. So honestly, going back to the Elmo thing, I have been having a tough week. Mm-hmm. And then I topped it off with seeing this movie.
Oh, no.
The emotional whiplash was wildly too much. So I just want to preface this entire review with that, like, if it seems like I just paused or am confused about something, I was just whipping back and forth. Also, I saw this by myself in the theater, and, like, there was moments where I was like, oh, no, just to myself in an empty theater because there's no one to, like, yes, commiserate with me at certain points.
That is great. That is wonderful. I love that. The fact that you're like, I had a crappy week, and then I saw this movie, and yeah, it just, it was on brand, is what. Amy, first impressions.
Well, I am not in the same boat as Spencer, so there's that. There were people in my theater. So first impression, this is...
No. He didn't say that there wasn't anybody in the theater. He didn't go with anybody.
No, I'm saying there was nobody in your theater?
Yeah.
That's why when I said, oh no, I said that out loud.
Even I understood that. When you're like, there's nobody to commiserate with me. I was like, there was nobody in the theater.
I thought you meant like you didn't go with anybody.
No. And like, I double checked just because I wanted to make sure I wasn't being rude.
That is even better. Sorry, go ahead, Amy.
So first impressions, this is a lot of Emma Stone that I saw that now I can't unsee. But there's a lot of questions, and it made me think about a lot of different things. So I left perplexed, but trying to keep most of my thoughts to myself because there's a lot of things in this movie, and I wanted to talk about them with people.
My first impression was literally, so this is what Andrew Garfield saw all those years.
Damn. Oh my gosh. Because
I'm like, there is way too, I mean, there was a lot in this movie. There was a lot of Emma Stone. There was a lot of Mark Ruffalo I didn't really want to see, but I saw. This movie was, first off, it was surprising for someone like Emma Stone, whom I think the closest thing I ever saw her be as this explicit was probably the Easy A.
Even then, she wasn't that explicit.
No, I'm saying the most explicit that I've seen her has probably got to be either the Easy A, because even in La La Land, she wasn't like this. Obviously, The Amazing Spider-Man, she definitely wasn't like this.
In The Favorite, she gets a little bit sketchy.
Yeah, but to this extent.
No, to not. Hence why I said there's a lot more of Emma Stone in this.
But that was literally my first thought as soon as I left the theater. I'm like, so this was essentially like a crash course in the relationship between Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone. Like, because I don't believe they're together anymore. And I don't think that after she would have, if they were still together after filming this movie, they would have been together still. I don't know. I'm just, you know, being a jerk. But this movie definitely took a hard right turn towards the artistic expression kind of vibe. And I had to put away my sensibility and put on like my artistic contemplation hat for this movie. And honestly, and this seems to be the theme for the beginning of the year, it really needed, it needed a second viewing. I didn't get a second viewing, but it needed one because there was a lot of things that I was just kind of like, wait, did I really grab that information from that? Or was I just imagining things, whatever? So, but let's dive into this. Let's talk about performers. Preferably ones that haven't had sex in the movie, and we'll get to those ones that do.
Max!
first off, I really do want to highlight Willem Dafoe's character in this movie. I really, for the fact that this man got up every day at like 3 a.m, had to have 4 hours of prosthetics put on him for every day he shot, and he stated too in interviews that he couldn't even sleep because he had to be awake for, you know, the direction of the people who were putting in the prosthetics, the effects people. He had to be awake to work with them to make sure all the prosthetics got put on correctly. So he couldn't even sleep. It was 4 hours in the chair putting on, 2 hours taking off. And that's a lot of work for anybody who's had to have copious amounts of time in the effects chair for prosthetic work. I think Jim Carrey had to, you know, put it best that it was ultimately borderlining torture. So I can only imagine how well Willem Dafoe had to, you know, push through it and all that. But his character in this movie is so interesting. Like, every time you saw him, every time he divulged more of his past, you just had to be like, where did this come from? Like, who is this character, like, derived from? Because that person needs to be asked if they're okay. You know, because with everything that Willem Dafoe's character went through in this movie, which, what was his name in the movie?
Godwin Baxter.
His character just suffered. Like, his whole lot in life was just suffering. And Willem Dafoe played it quite seamlessly without any hiccup. Was there anybody else you guys wanted to talk about?
I mean, there's so many people that we can talk about.
No, well, I'm throwing it out there because I don't want to take up everybody.
I think I just have to directly go to Mark Ruffalo and Duncan. Mostly because, just like, I thought he was going to be in the movie for a lot less than he ended up being in the movie.
He was in it for a long time.
Yeah, I thought, like, you know, oh, come with me on an adventure. And then he was going to, like, dump her because he was really playing sleazebag very well.
Yeah.
But flash forward to later in the movie when he's just crying outside her room in Paris.
Oh, my God.
I was like, this man went on a journey. And it was fantastic to watch.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think Mark Ruffalo is the biggest surprise for the film. One of the biggest surprises for the film, for the fact that, like I said, he has played, like, for the first part of his career, he played the rom-com guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the next part of his career, the next leg, he did some serious films, some drama films, things like that for a short stint. But his biggest leg of his career has got to be Marvel. I mean, you're looking at what, 20 plus years of, or no, not 20, sorry.
It's at least 15.
Yeah, at least 15 years of putting on the persona of Bruce Banner and being the Hulk. That's got to be like one of those kind of things where, like with Robert Downey Jr., as we've seen, you either learn to embrace that this is who you are, or number two, you do your best to like run from it when you can to do something completely opposite. Whether or not if it fails...
Chris Evans.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, Chris Evans. Where Chris Evans did a couple of, like, romantic comedy movies or other things, and it was, like, hit or miss. I know he did one where he played an older brother to a, like, a kid prodigy.
Yep.
At one point in time, which was okay. I saw that one. His really big kind of breakout moment from the Captain America role was his opportunity in Knives Out.
Yeah,
which, super commendable. Mark Ruffalo absolutely destroyed any thought of him being Bruce Banner in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of like how much of a, I want to say heel turn, but it wasn't just a heel turn. It was like a complete 180 of the characters that he's used to doing before. I don't think I've ever seen him be this much of a jerk or a sleazebag in anything. Yeah. To that level.
Yeah, I agree. He embodies like so many things. And even he had said, because we were watching a Variety breakdown of the scene or something on YouTube. He's like, I super wasn't sure about this because he is so narcissistic and just, and he used the word cocksure. And I was like, yep, there you go, buddy. But he's like, this isn't me. And then the director's like, no, that's you. And I think that's such a note that the director had decided that Mark not only was capable, but that he could embody it so well, and not that it would be such a shock, but that he was so good at it. And that's the thing I'm like, oh, so you see like what the actor can do. Cool.
Well, and even during filming, like there's stories about like, and Mark Ruffalo has talked about it, how while even on set, he still wasn't sure of himself, to the point to where he had doubts that he was doing the performance right. He would essentially like half joke to Willem Dafoe and to other people on the set that his friend Oscar Isaac, who was apparently filming on a nearby soundstage, was going to be called in and replace him like on the spot.
Seriously?
In fact, it got to the point to where Willem Dafoe pranked Mark Ruffalo, and Dafoe took him to a room where Oscar Isaac, who was already in on the joke, was waiting, and both Oscar Isaac and Willem Dafoe informed Ruffalo he was fired and indeed getting replaced by Isaac, which was a joke to him. But I mean, to the point to where like Mark Ruffalo kind of has to know by now that he is an outstanding performer. and it kind of humanizes him a bit as a actor, to the fact that even in moments like this, where he has a long history, a long career in film, that he even gets like doubts about the role that is so definitively given to him by the director. I just, after everything else that you know about Mark Ruffalo, who is a active activist for a lot of the wrongs that are going on in the world, he shows up at like marches, he shows up for picket events, he speaks consistently out against like the evils of the world. I feel like this man could literally walk into this studio at any minute and just like sit down and be like, hey guys, what's up? And then just start talking to us. Like, that's how human he has made himself look throughout his career. So was there anybody else that we wanted to talk about outside of the obvious?
I want to bring up a kind of random one, and I had to actually track her down because she had an interesting pivot point, but as a character, she was really unexpected. Her character's name was Madame Sweeney. And she is the madam at a brothel in Paris where Emma Stone's Bella ends up. But she's played by Catherine Hunter, who I had no idea who this woman was until it said that she was Arabella Fig in the Harry Potter series. So you see her really, really briefly. She's this little old lady. But she was surprising, like, in not only how she presented herself and how her character presented themselves, but also the sheer tremendous amount of tattoo work that was all over her body. Like, it was nuts. And then also how she created a matter-of-fact balance in not only her profession and what she was doing and how she was helping, how she saw she was helping people. And it was really well done in such a strange space of where we ended up in that. We're almost to the third act at that point. And so I was like, okay. And then she also bites people's earlobes. So yeah.
It was interesting because it was like, and mind you, we'll get into that scene, but that scene was very interesting to me as well. And I have thoughts on that, but Catherine Hunter was also, I don't know if you guys ever saw that, that movie Tale of Tales, but she played the witch in that one.
Oh, I did see that one.
Yeah, so she was in that one as well. But yeah, she was actually a really interesting character that brought a lot of nuance to what could have been a pretty straightforward type of scene or act, I guess, because she's in that act throughout it. Like, she instantly became a very complicated character.
Yeah.
Because, like, we'll talk about her in a second. Anybody else that you guys want to talk about?
Well, we have to talk about Emma Stone.
Emma Stone.
We can't not talk about Emma Stone at this junction.
Actually, before Emma Stone, there is Rami Youssef, who played Max McCandles.
He was another one that was unexpected, but in the swap, I thought he was going to be in longer than he turned out to be. Ruffalo swap, I was like, what?
I gotta give a shout out to Rami Youssef. He was a great addition to that first act, part of the second, and the fourth act. His whole role in this was very interesting because you see the evolution of his character done really well. It was subtle, but it was done really well. As playing opposite of course, the woman we're gonna talk about now, the woman of the hour, Emma Stone. Emma Stone really took everybody by surprise in this movie. Without a doubt, her interpretation of Bella Baxter from the novel to this film was absolutely superb. I don't know what went on in her life or what was going on currently. And I say that not to be rude or anything. Amy's laughing, but
I'm chuckling because you're like, I don't know.
No.
It's almost like, I don't know what water she drank. But give me some of that.
All I know is that to the director's credit, she really did do things on screen that I don't think I would have ever thought I'd seen Emma Stone do. We're not talking like just explicit, but even the evolution of her character and creating those evolutionary points for the character to where her understanding of Bella as a character was so unique and totally different than what I was expecting for her role, because you come to understand Pertaining to the story, Bella is essentially a woman who was pregnant who tried to commit suicide. And when Dr. Godwin Baxter found her, she was literally in her last dying breaths, last moments. So what does he do, as any good doctor apparently at the time? He takes the unborn fetus out, takes the brain out of the fetus, removes the brain of the now obviously dead Bella, and inserts, we'll get to that, into the Bella character, and implants in her the brain of an infant, a baby, essentially. And she's essentially this female Frankenstein character.
She's a chimera.
Because
there's a lot less. This is...
So
we have definitions of what Bella is, not only defined as by who Bella is.
Yeah,
she is a creation. We could establish.
I mean, to the extent of what would qualify as a type of Frankenstein's monster, she is more in line with that than, because there's not multiple parts. It's just.
But Frankenstein's monster was created of multiple parts. She's literally like part of a part of herself and not of herself simultaneously. So it's weird. It's
if you read Mary Shelley's book, the biggest
thing
that makes the monster who he is the brain, which is why this is so. And I guess this just allows us to kind of dive into the story. Did anybody else have anything else to say about Emma Stone?
Spencer?
I mean, she did a fantastic job. Like, it was a ride, but like she did like...
You are literally setting me up for all these different things, and I'm trying not to say it for good taste.
Well, don't. Be in good taste.
My goodness. I could say really briefly without breaking good taste. Emma, and I think you hit kind of the nail on the head. The evolution of Bella Baxter as portrayed by Emma Stone kind of borders almost on it. You think it could have been written, but it feels almost like it's instinct for her and how she's growing the character.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of things you're like, that I didn't see that happening. And just in general, in the growth of her as the story progresses. And there are moments where you can see Emma Stone, who had, like, Emma Stone when she was Gwen Stacy, Emma Stone when she was in Easy A. Like, you can see little flickers, but you never really ever have those moments where it's not Bella Baxter at her core. So diving into the story aspect, I guess?
I guess.
Fisted to you.
The story itself is a very unique tale during the Victorian era. Yorgos Lanthimos really does an interesting job of portraying the Victorian era at the time, utilizing interesting palettes of color, as well as techniques of filming. There are so many interesting lens choices for this movie that really made it interesting for certain transitions and whatnot, where it went from a simple wide angle to almost like a fisheye type lens to filming with unique handhelds, to even filming with LED backdrops. There was a lot of technical expertise done in this film. And I can see why this movie is getting a lot of attention for that alone.
I mean, it should, really. Like, just even dealing with the shock of the movie as it was unfurling, like, the thing that I could really grab onto was the interesting camera shots,
mm-hmm.
because they were just like throughout the movie, like everything was visually interesting to look at.
It really was. And I think that's in itself, it's commendable as a, you know, as the effort of utilizing unique storytelling through, you know, camera work.
Hmm.
And then you get to the actual story. and then the actual story itself is so, so off the wall that I'm really interested in wanting to read the book just for the fact of wanting to see how the adaptation kind of lines up. I know it's not going to entirely. To be honest, I'm even wondering if Mark Ruffalo's character was in the original story. So I'm just, there's a lot of questions I have pertaining to that. But The story itself, it's as we stated, pretty straightforward. She's a type of amalgam of a baby brain in a grown woman's body, and we are watching Emma Stone's interpretation of the evolutionary process of a woman's mind in such a short time as she comes to grip with not only the male construct within the Victorian era as the hierarchy of, you know, where men's places are in the world as opposed to women's, but even the the fast-paced, like, understanding of puberty, not puberty, but like sexual awakenings. This movie had a lot of sex. I think we could just easily say that without a doubt.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how the even the evolution of the portrayal of sex shifts throughout this movie. You get this understanding, this awakening from Bella's character at the beginning that is more nuanced to adolescence, and we see how her shifting through in quick fashion, how most people who go through those types of changes throughout life, how, you know, from adolescence to young adulthood to, you know, middle age, we see that in such a short time, her understanding of not only sex but the world around her, and how her sexuality is probably the only thing that she can control during this era. However, it does come at a cost. We see those the fallout of those decisions, as well as the perception of society at the time. I think it's really interesting to note that at the beginning of this movie, when she finds out about her body in that way, the first thing that she's told in that is that people don't do that in polite society, mm-hmm. Which is true. We're not saying that people should go out and start doing things like that in the middle of nowhere around other people. But that is the first kind of response she gets when she is making people aware of the discovery, as she puts it, which is there's a whole plethora of like conversations that could be kind of just balanced around that premise alone, and how even in the world today we view sexuality and we view sex in general as such a taboo thing that as we stated last week in lesson 384 talking about the Book of Clarence, mm-hmm. How we mentioned how we actually, us three, come from a religious background. And conversations about sex were not very plenty, unless you were being chastised regarding things that you hadn't even done.
Aggressively so.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Spencer, but were you ever given that type of talk through the lens of Christianity?
Yeah. Yeah, they're like, now that I'm older, I realize those were not good talks.
Nope.
Mostly like,
yeah, no.
Like, because like you guys had the one like with the cake where it's like, you know, it's the same as like the duct tape thing where like, you know,
everyone, I have no idea what you're talking about.
The duct tape
about.
One?
Really? Oh. That almost never happens.
Usually okay, wait, Kristen, you don't circles, know about the duct tape one?
Hold on. What are you guys talking about?
About the...
Well, now I'm curious about what happened with you. So
we were just told no. We were just like,
oh,
don't
you know?
Oh, you did? You didn't get allegories and hands-on experience?
I'm sorry, hands-on experience?
No.
I'm sorry, what?
So cake.
Do we need to call somebody?
Spencer, tell about the cake and I'll tell about the duct tape.
Hold on. So let me just... It sounds like I need to go first and then you guys... So hold on.
All right, let's hear it.
So... Growing up, I grew up in the church from age eight or nine, all the way through. And being a part of, like, because we were actively always a part of different things within the church. So whether if it was children's church, youth group, worship team, prayer ministry team, all the things I was a part of. So when it came to things concerning sex and the conversations about it, or... should I say the chastising of those instances, everything was always in the mindset of like prevention before it's even considered. It was always like, don't think about, you know, doing the devil's deed, or don't ever think about blah, blah, blah. Like, no, I
just basically got told a stern no and didn't get what we got, Spence.
So we got told, like, you know, you need to make sure you remain pure, you know, you're because I remember those conversations where they would have to separate the guys and the girls, but the girls were literally just right behind us, so you could hear the girls' conversation while the guys were having their conversation, and nobody really paid attention to the guys. But it was like, oh, you know, you have to protect your flower, and the guys, you know, you have to make sure that, you know what, you save it for marriage, and that it's a gift of God, and if you ever decide to do it, that you're gonna make God cry. And it's like I got a lot of shame. So I got a lot of shame, and I so you understand, I came up in the church from a very religiously strict Pentecostal background. In the mindset that every other month was revival month. So we did things like hour-long worship sessions and burnings of, like, evil satanic items.
Did we talk about you losing your CDs and whatnot?
Oh, yeah. Because I also remember.
I think it was on the air when you talked about, like, you would have to bring things in for the burning.
Yeah, so bring things in for the burning. And there was the. Yeah, I don't want to get.
Yeah.
But, like, so a lot of my conversations were based around, like, no, don't do that. That's not what this time is for. God is watching. God is always watching. He's looking from above, and he sees you when you're doing those things in secret. And so if you decide to do, you know, touch yourself or whatever, it's like, God is watching.
So there's Eddie Spencer.
Okay. All right, I got to hear this.
Okay.
You get the cake.
So
I get
I'm just going to say it like you said to me. All right. So imagine that I had a cake, right, Eddie?
Okay.
Okay. So then I just put my hands in the cake and then I start to eat it. Yeah. And then I'm like, here you go, Eddie. Have some cake. Would you like to have this cake?
Did you wash your hands?
That's irrelevant.
That's
wrong question. You failed.
Yeah.
The correct answer is no, you wouldn't, because it's gross to have people's seconds, and that's the attachment to sex.
I love
it. Did you just say seconds?
Yes.
That's considered seconds?
Yes.
I love Spencer and I are on the same page. It didn't. If you're like, did you wash your hands? It's like, wrong question.
You get slapped.
But it's like, Spencer's my friend. If he touches his cake, as long as he didn't, like... Did you wear protection when you died? Did you have a glove on, Spencer?
No, you go in unprotected.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Sure. Okay.
So that was Spencer's one.
Duct tape.
So again, much like Eddie and Spencer, we were raised in the church. Mine was the duct tape. You get a big piece of duct tape. You put it on your arm, or some people would
You put it on your arm?
You put it on your arm, and you make sure they would make you rub it in. So
Wait, they actually put duct tape on you?
Yes!
They didn't do that!
They did me! Because I went to a white Pentecostal church in Sacramento area.
Man, at least my church didn't abuse me.
So
like
rub the duct tape on your arm, and then they would go, okay, now rip it off. And so you had people, they're like, like Band-Aid, they would try to rip it. No, they would want you to rip it off in one shot. And they're like, see, this is what happens when you have sex. You notice you can't
rip it off?
No, you can't go. You've lost
I'm a guy. That's not supposed to be the way.
You lost all the hair on your arm. You can't go back. You forever changed, and you'll never look at duct tape ever the same again. Also, we had the conversation about protecting your flower. And I got to say, as a woman, I was not only like, no, don't do it. It was, I am shameful. I am bringing everybody down around me. Like, even if I looked at you the wrong way, Spencer, like I will draw you into lusting after me. And it is so frustrating to be any type of growing in a church environment where they do not, that your body and you existing as a female is shame, period. You are dirty, unclean, and bringing everybody down on the boat with you. So I'm glad that you didn't. The cake one was hilarious, though, because we had people eating that cake straight up afterwards, too.
The thing I don't understand is why they actually put tape on you. I know that tape is bad on the second do. Like,
yeah.
Like, everyone knows this.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Remember, teenagers, you want to prove a point.
That's just, I mean, I feel like that's scary.
So I love that Eddie got the polite, I mean, no, here's, and Spencer got the cake, and then the duct tape talk, but never had it applied.
But here's the thing too, like, understanding sex, like, I'm not going to lie, I'm one of those kids who grew up learning all about sex from movies. So everything that came to, like, about knowing certain aspects about it, is like, oh yeah, I saw Species, I know what happens. Or, oh yeah, I saw Showgirls, I know what happens. Or, oh, I saw Striptease, I know what happens. Or, oh, I mean, literally, like, I was talking, I think I was talking to you, Ames, about one of my actual, like, guilty pleasure movies, because it's so just ridiculous, but it was also interesting at the same point, is a movie with Andy Garcia called Internal Affairs with Richard Gere and Andy Garcia.
Oh, wait, I remember you bringing this up for a long time, and he's a bad cop. Richard Gere
is essentially a cop who is sleeping with pretty much everybody. And at the beginning of the movie, him and his partner are chasing down this perpetrator, and his partner ends up shooting him in the back, but he didn't have a weapon on hand. So Richard Gere puts a knife on him, plants a knife. And then Andy Garcia comes in as Internal Affairs to kind of do the whole thing. And he turns into this whole crazy thing, you know, which is probably why Richard Gere got that weird rumor with the gerbil. But either way,
no, Spencer, don't.
No, I remember.
You
know,
oh, yeah. You remember. Okay, good.
But the fact is that, like, I grew up, like, learning more about sex from movies than I did from the church, which says a lot about how we grew up. So fast forward to now, and this movie is an interesting perspective as somebody who started from that with the church, mm-hmm. to what this movie portrays as part of the recognition of what sex is and how it is perceived by a lot of people in either polite societies, religious societies, anything like that. And yet it is probably one of the most natural things that people do, as opposed to, like, other things. Law of attraction and all that.
Well, and also we need to establish that in Bella being Bella and progressing through the stages of development, she's not hampered by strict religious upbringing, no. by rigors of society or expectation, which we see from the jump.
Which in fact, really quick to kind of interject, I just want to say quite the opposite pertaining to how she's brought up. She's actually given a very strong foundation of a scientific approach to everything.
Yeah, which is question continuing. It's question everything, continue to learn. And through learning, through experience, you learn and can obtain more knowledge, which can help, you know, direct how you choose to grow. But she's like, she's literally, once she finds out that, what was it, the road to she calls it something basically, but she learns by accident, masturbating is good, makes her happy.
It's
the happiness. It's the rubbing.
Find the joy or find the happiness.
Something like that. That. It's only mentioned once that we don't do it in polite society, but everybody already knows that she's doing it once she knocks the plate off the table and she goes upstairs. And then they suddenly decide at that point that she should be married, because if we don't get her married, because she's found, you know, happiness by rigorously stimulating herself, as Max put it, then she will become not a pariah, but she'll become a problem to society. So you wife her up as quick as you can. And the thing is that that's where we have that intersection of Mark Ruffalo's Duncan, who just straight up comes in and is like, puts his hands down her pants. And she's like, he knows what I like. I go with him. And so we're in this place of where she's not confined by the expectations of religions or society, other than the drive to continue to pursue knowledge and experience for the sake of learning,
mm-hmm.
and that in
as well as what makes her happy
and what makes her happy, which in turn helps to, not as you said, creates a great strong foundation for her, but also creates boundaries and a very straightforwardness that is so sure-footed that she's like, nope, I don't like you anymore, or this isn't working for us, why are you doing that? And the candor of it is something that I almost aspire to at that point, because I'm like, shoot, I wish I could just be like, yeah, no, I don't like that you did that. That sucks. Okay, I'm going to go that way. Bye. Like, I can't.
Yeah. It is. It's a very nuanced but still fresh, I guess, one, if you want to say, approach to portraying sex during that time. I mean, which if you look at other films, obviously like The Favorite, which The Favorite has elements of sexual liberty as well in mm-hmm. the film. And then if you take a look at just the history books by itself, like, you know, doing things of this nature was something that isn't talked about, but it did happen. I mean, it has always been a part of society to, in a quote unquote dignified manner, find one's happiness at any case in point or at any time. I mean, everybody, I'm not gonna say everybody knows, but if you go back to like during the times of like the Renaissance era, where there are chairs for women who have open bottom seats that were meant for people to, there were particular people who were given the task to pleasure the women, yeah, while in,
you're also forgetting the way to cure hysteria.
Yeah.
Which was literally a doctor would come and bring some type of dildo to masturbate the woman until
some type of phallic device.
Phallic device. We're putting an explicit on this. I'm not swearing. It's all science names.
Science.
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 But to essentially bring her to orgasm so that it would quote unquote cure her hysteria. And mm. that was practiced in Greece and was still continued to be practiced in the Victorian era, yep. as, in and of itself. So you had male doctors, because there weren't female doctors allowed, that would come and be doing this all the time. So let's talk, the taboo nature of sex in and of itself has been just riddled through history everywhere. Yeah.
And so you, with that understanding, Lanthimos, the director, I would say it takes a bold approach to create a film where it is strictly focused on not only recognizing the restriction that women had during that time, but even how the history books were written to remove this aspect of our human history as, oh, everybody was proper and everyone was just like, no, if people are horn dogs today, they were horn dogs then, mm-hmm. you know, and there were people who had very much, you know, high libidos, and I'm pretty sure they did X, Y, and Z. I mean, if there's people like Duncan, obviously there, I mean, why wouldn't there in that same fashion be similar people who had high drives like Emma Stone's character, like Bella?
Well, I think therein lies the irony of it, that the characters, the cads, the rakes, akin to Mark Ruffalo's Duncan, were celebrated and honored. And if you were a woman,
and conquerors, and they were considered,
the, yeah. Yes, and there were all these wonderful, brilliant things. And as a woman, you were seen consistently less than. And that hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. Even though we can talk about sexual liberation, it is still, especially in the U.S., is considered to be not only a taboo subject, it is something that we are uncomfortable with as a whole. And I think that's something that this movie does. We talked about it, that this film received a standing ovation at the Venice Film Festival, and people have remarked about how committed Emma Stone has been to her portrayal and her forthright vigor, I guess, of how she has gone into these sex scenes. And in America, it's uncomfortable because we're like, this is a lot of nudity. This is a lot of somebody who is seeking happiness. And it is not the focus of a male. Like, it's, we're not being watching like Mark Ruffalo getting, you know, getting off. You see less of his face in orgasm, which you never do, than hers. And I don't know if that is a direct push to acknowledge that women can obtain pleasure themselves or from however they choose. And it's there. And it's not like, oh, it's in your face. Look at it. But it's like, acknowledge, this is here. It hasn't disappeared. It's not going anywhere. And it yeah. hasn't changed like ever.
Yeah, I agree. And I think utilizing sex as a vehicle to further not only help display Emma's or Bella, sorry, Bella's progression as a logical thinking person, but also as a means to show her ability to be kind of a what's the word I'm looking for here?
The means of her own production.
Well, that too as well, but
which is literally a quote.
But also like also to create the honest clarity of her. I had the word in my mind. Oh my gosh, her own person essentially, like to create her not needing anyone. Her
she's the means of her own production. I think that's when we get to the point where we're going through the story and she's growing. She's run off with Duncan, with Mark Ruffalo. They've gone off to Lisbon, which has this great moment where she has to chloroform Max, who's her betrothed. And she's like, and I'm out, peace. And then, you know, Willem Dafoe lets her go in such like a very parent, like, I can't stop you. I love you. You're going to go anyway. Just take this money. Let's go. She gets to Lisbon. Her and Mark Ruffalo are just going at it crazy. And then you start to see the insecurities that Mark Ruffalo are being brought up as Bella continues to grow. And she's experiencing things. And she's not like out, you know, boning everybody. She's literally like, she had more pastries. She heard somebody sing. She's walked around. She went and tried alcohol. Like, she's done all these things to continue to grow and experience so that she can learn. And he's becoming more and more threatened by her continued progress towards
her own independence, yeah, essentially
to being a full human or the best version of herself. And when we get to the point where they've lost their money, she's been introduced to philosophy, she no longer wants to sleep with Mark Ruffalo, and they are in they're in Paris, and she figures out, she's like, well, if I go to this place and I have sex with people, they'll pay me and then I can have money to live. And then I only have to do this for X amount of time during an hour, and then I can go do whatever the heck I want. And it was this great balance of like, she is fully capable of being a learned woman and she can still, one, please herself and make money. She's the means of her own production. And she literally quotes it. And I was dying because I was like, nope, you hit the nail on the head. And then Mark Ruffalo, who you think has like, he finds out that she has, quote, as he's been calling it, she's been whoring. He gets
peeved. His words.
Yes. Yeah. He gets peeved and she pulls out money. She's like, I'm going to send you home. And he's like, where did you get the money? She's like, it's, you know, it, and she calls Godwin God. She's like, it's God's money. And he's like, we needed that. She's like, when do we need this? And so it's this great juxtaposition. But then we get Mark Ruffalo in probably just one of the most brilliantly absurd but earnest portrayals of a man who just cannot let go. He is the vindictive ex. And he simultaneously branches an understanding of both, I've known women who act like him and men who act like him. And so I'm just like, yep, yes, Mark Ruffalo, I see you over there.
And I think a lot of it is also the fact that it poses the question, what if you flip the script and you put someone with the same bravado and just lack of filter within the male stereotype, the male construct during that time. What if you put that into a female mindset and allow them to carry those same types of abilities, like of just being independent, not thinking of what other people think, just pushing forward and having that type of lifestyle? Like, what is it? What does that do to the male psyche of that time? And it essentially crumbles it. It destroys it.
But so you're like, I want to talk.
No,
about
I was
this.
Just gonna say like. Because, okay, again, emotional whiplash. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit delayed in picking up on some things. It took me forever to notice the half, like, animals around Godwin's house.
Yes!
I was like, wait a minute, what?
There's a chick-a-pig. I loved the chick-a-pig.
But, like, yeah, that was another thing. Like, even though Mark Ruffalo in Paris was, like, the funniest thing in this dang movie. Because like, he was falling apart. And I fully didn't understand why at the time. But, like, reviewing it, I was like, oh, yeah, I guess he's losing control. So it makes sense. Yeah. But, like, just him being a pouty little baby, right? Was the most hilarious thing to me in this movie.
Well, and he also brings up, even when they're in Lisbon, they're sitting down to dinner and he's like, you know, women don't fall in love with me too fast because, you know, it happens. And he's so used to the women who are swept up by the grandeur of it. And Bella's like, whatever. Like, okay, I'm going to go over there. That's in the same space of when she goes, she didn't like the food, and she goes, excuse me, I have to go punch that baby now. And she gets up and walks with the cock dog.
I was literally like, I have never been more hurt in a moment in the theaters than this point right now. Like, it's like,
it's so good.
I have thought that at times, and I'm like, in polite society, I wouldn't do that.
But it is polite society. And I think that's also one of the quick lessons that she absorbs is that when she goes to punch his baby after she spit out the food, she's sitting next to Duncan and they're at a table with these people and he's like, ho, 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 so great. And when he takes her outside to have the conversation with her about, you know, you don't do this, you don't do that, he gives her three phrases. And then he tells her, that's it. That's all you're going to say for the rest of the night. And she goes in and she follows the rules. But you also see that she's like, yeah, this is what you told me to do and I'm going to do it. But that's today. Mm-hmm. Like, that's this right now. And you're not getting very far from this ever again.
I think if ever there was a great scene that epitomized that the second act of the film, it was that dancing scene where she chooses to go out and start dancing. And she doesn't know how to dance. However, she is just letting loose and having fun. And Duncan, thinking that he needs to go and rein her in or keep his attachment on her, tries to keep up, and he is not able to keep up with her. In fact, throughout most of that film, she is leading in that dance, and he is trying to either keep up, adapt, and he is not able to. Mm-hmm. And it's apparent by the end of their dance that he is out of his element. She is ready to keep dancing, and it's a great picture of the fact that she is moving on without him. She is evolving past the means and the needs of him.
Well, and that's where we also get to the point where he puts her in a trunk and gets her on a boat. He's literally like, get into the box. And she's like, okay. And she gets into the box just thinking like in that innocence of trust. And when she gets on the boat and he's like, we're on a boat, it'll be easier for me to find you. You suddenly like you had started to see the slow creep of his needs for control, like while they're in Lisbon. And now he's like, I've got you cornered. And that's where she starts to actually, she makes friends, but she dives into philosophy. And then when they get to Alexandria, they're on their way to Greece, but they stop in Alexandria and she has this heartbreaking moment of something that I was just touched at, because the earnesty and honesty of a kid when you see somebody hurting.
Well, not
you
even
just want to help.
Well, and not even a kid, but like, I mean, we've all been at that point where we were younger, like adolescent age, and we see the world for what it is and we want to just dive in and save it. I mean, that is a very teenage thing to do for most of us. Like, I know, you know, again, growing up in the church and all that, our church would take several trips to Mexico and we would see these pictures and we'd see whatever of like impoverished areas. And you just like, you want to get up and you just want to drop everything and go and try to help. Like, that is a very young adult, late teen mindset to just, I don't know how to help. All I can do is this. Here, take my money, or here, I can send you this, or I'll, you know, write letters or whatever so that you can take with. Like, that is so much the breaking point for a lot of young people at that time to recognize that the world is bigger than just them. And I feel like that was a great way to put that into a scene and make it aware, like make us aware of like where she's at along her timeline. I think moving forward, when you get into the fourth act just takes a left turn, because by that point, she is getting ready to actually marry Max McCandles.
Well, she finds out in a letter, because she writes not the best and she draws lots of pictures, but she finds out that God, her dad, is dying, and he asks her to come home. And when she comes home, she has the conversation with Max, which is very, very practical and very sound. Like, there's not a lot of deep, impassioned moments. It's just, she literally...
It's very logical in the process of how they pursue their continual betrothal, because before she leaves, he does ask for her hand in marriage and she accepts. And so they are meant to be betrothed. Coming back because of her sick creator slash father, they restart, because I wouldn't even say rekindle. It's more like a just restart the conversations for betrothal. But during the course of that, obviously, they end up going to the church to get married. But then there's this big bomb that's dropped where Duncan, who has been losing his mind throughout the entire time and has actually even spent time in an insane asylum, mm-hmm. has found Bella's actual husband, whom before she jumped, she was actually a woman named Victoria, who was married to a very vicious and hateful man.
A sadistic general.
And so she decides, in the effort of logic and science, to go and see what life is with the general.
Mm-hmm. What did she leave behind, essentially? Like, who was she before she became Bella?
Looked like you had to say, you want to say something.
Oh, no.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. and mind you, within that fourth act, we kind of see this slowing down of Bella's evolution as a character, but we see her processing outside of science for the first time. Mm. Her recognizing, yeah, maybe this endeavor in this scientific experiment to understand who I was before was probably not the best choice, mm-hmm. and so I need to do something about it. I was reading a few reviews, and a lot of people said that it kind of lagged in that fourth act, but I feel like, honestly, that was kind of the cherry on the top for her arc altogether. For her coming to the point to where she realizes, number one, not everything can be solved through scientific thinking. Sometimes you have to lead from your heart and choose to make decisions based on what is actually, going back to the sexual liberty thing, what you want, and not just out of the necessity of what is based in scientific truth. We're not going to give away how this ends, but ultimately the film does end on a very unique and whimsical note. And I have to say that I did appreciate the way everything wraps up, even though it is slightly ambiguous as to the nature of relationships with everyone within the confines of who is still there. Mm-hmm. It is left to the assumption of the viewer that everyone is just choosing to be them. Everyone is choosing themselves for that moment, for that time. And I feel like that really carries a lot more weight into the arc of Bella doesn't need to get married to have a happy ending. She doesn't need to do this heinous act or fix that thing or save this person or do whatever. She is just going to continue to exist and thrive. And that carries over with a lot of other people who are still in the film at that point. I don't know. What do you think, Spence?
Really the ending I thought was, like, ambiguous, yes, but, like, I feel like it wrapped up enough that I wasn't, like, traumatized by the movie.
That's a plus.
No, like, I was like, okay, this is, an appropriate place for an ending. That's how I kind of feel about it.
Yeah, I agree. Let's go and talk about any issues or highlights. I want to start with Amy.
Highlights. I loved some of the futuristic like backgrounds and the LED. Yeah, the clouds and the water when they're on the ship. Even the futuristic way Lisbon is kind of designed and Alexandria. It's such a like visual like whoa moment that I can't unsee it, and it was really just absolutely kind of it tickled the steampunk fancy in me that I so long ago tried to quell. So that's a definite highlight for me, but I'm gonna pass around the table first before I try to give in anything else. Spencer.
Okay, so music in this movie. It's good, but also very uncomfortable, which is a very, I don't feel like I've ever really thought that about a soundtrack before.
Yeah.
But like they did a great job on making the music uncomfortable and kind of stunted and kind of grow with Bella throughout the movie. Because, like, you know, by the time you're getting to the end, like, then it's just like a beautiful, like, you know, orchestra that's playing. But at the beginning, it's like the sound at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Off and awkward.
Yeah.
But, like, overall, good job, but, like, very interesting.
Yeah. Ames, I kind of want to know what your issue is, because I kind of want to just get all of whatever you have to say out now, so that way it's not...
Issue?
I thought you said you had more.
No.
Oh,
I had other things I could applaud, but I didn't want to take... Do you have anything that you have that an issue or a highlight?
I honestly feel like there has to be such a huge highlight for Emma Stone's acting in this film. Mm-hmm. I feel like her ability, not only as the vocal performance, but even the physical performance of how everything from how she portrayed herself as an infant-minded person to the way she walked, to kind of even giving a sense of her walk, never fully refining, but it is still very uniquely her as the character Bella throughout the entire film. She never fully has this gracefulness when she walks. It is always this sense of like staccatoed kind of step in this really weird frame of the way she walked. I felt like that was such a big part of her projecting not fully cognitive, not fully physically refined, not fully there, and yet always will be that person. Like that is the mark of Bella. Between that and her honest ability to have those really like straightforward conversations with every person that she just had no time for, mm-hmm. like they were just so well balanced in the conversation, and Emma Stone delivered them perfectly. I just got to say Emma Stone did wonders in this role that I would have never expected Emma Stone to do. Everyone else, they did great, and it's because I expected most of them to do great because they're great actors that I know of. I'm familiar with a lot of their work. Emma Stone, it's hit or miss for me in certain roles. I haven't really seen her do like period drama like this. Out, you know, obviously, apparently she does it in The Favorite. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that one. But, you know, even her role in Birdman, like her role in Birdman was a angsty young daughter of Michael Keaton. And she does that well. And yet, this is something on a whole different level. So I think that's my biggest highlight. Issues with the movie. Sometimes the filming did get a little dizzying at times, the way it followed with the fisheye lens, certain scenes where the camera didn't move to follow people. It just turned, and that fisheye perspective kind of made it interesting to watch. Also, the frame rate changed throughout the film. So that was also part of my issue. It went from like 30 frames at one point to like 24 frames, probably dropped to 22, and then went up to like 50 at certain times on the fisheye part. And mind you, that's just the technical perspective of me. But yeah, I think that was probably it. Did you have something else to add?
Yeah, for highlight, the costuming. It was really well balanced, especially when we were seeing Bella as she progressed, where we don't really get her until the fourth act into more traditional Victorian design, like full design.
Well, because most of the time she's wearing shorts.
But that's the thing. She's never stopped whenever she's wearing that, where she's wearing essentially like almost like a slip shorts and go-go, white go-go boots. Like they're ankle boots with chunky heels. But the tops are all these big, voluminous, like balloon shouldered masterpieces that would be quintessentially Victorian. And so I think it's such a great way to see her in everything she's moving through in these different outfits, but she's coming to a space of like the top portion of her is recognizing the Victorian and the bottom is even more modern and progressive, and the design is great. And then when you get to see everybody else, the practicality in some of the costuming, but also the definitive portrayal of who they are is spoken really well through the costuming, which all it does is help to amplify and solidify the sets as well as just like the environment as a whole. So I really like the costuming in this.
Her sleeves actually on her wedding dress were actually a full meter wide, just the sleeves alone. So wow. Yeah, that's crazy.
She could fly away, baby.
Essentially.
Yeah. Emma Stone's dresses specifically were just like very interesting pieces.
Right.
Especially that like orange's number with like looked like she was like something out of the 80s with like that vest thing that she had on. I was like, these are interesting pieces and I like them. Yeah.
And to state that, like, how her dress evolves with her understanding of not only wearing things practical for the sake of just her being out in the world or her exploring or her doing studying, but also to the makeup of, like, she goes from really unique bright colors to more muted down. Her focus is on her now refining her mind as opposed to what she wears outside. Mm-hmm. So
also the textures were really great. The slip gown thing that she was wearing, which was like this weird kind of olivey green, had some really great pleats in it. And again, the shoulders were just going for days. Like, it was so neat to see.
So let's go ahead and go around to the round table question. I have a round table question that's kind of unique. I don't know if everybody has one, but I do want to pose it to the table. And so obviously with this movie, there's a lot of conversations about sexual liberty and finding one's own self through the course of discovery and self-exploration. So I want to ask the table, what film can you recall that you've seen shares a similar level, maybe not at the same level, but as a close enough level of sexual liberty that you've, you know, obviously seen? And I want to start with Spencer because I'm pretty sure I probably know what the answer is, but I still want to see if he has.
All right, I want you to look at me right now.
Okay. This is really awkward for this question, but sure.
The answer is no. No, I have not seen anything that's even remotely this close. Like, I'd have to, like, start to transform it into something else. Like, you know, the saddest movie I've ever seen. Like, which is Grave of the Fireflies.
Oh.
And this...
this is, this, yeah.
This one has so much sex on it that it's a comparable level to the sadness of Grave of the Fireflies. That is the closest that I can bring anything towards.
There you go. I will accept that. I mean, that's a lot. But okay. Ames.
I'm actually trying to look up the
she's got to research.
No, the movie when the movie came out. So I can talk to one that I cannot spell the name.
Are you gonna say Welcome to the Dollhouse?
No. 2002 Secretary. So if we're talking about sexual liberty or liberation, it does not surprisingly have a lot of sex in it, but it is very a very defined movie about sex in relation to the kink community, but also finding yourself. It is David Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and it's very unexpected. And so when we're talking about not only sexual liberation, but also the growth of a female protagonist in also embracing who she is, Maggie Gyllenhaal fits that for me in Secretary in juxtaposition to this. So less naked time in Secretary, but very similar like movements.
I've seen a lot of movies.
you brought up Showgirls. So I was like, if you want naked, Showgirls is going to give you that option.
That not even close. I mean, honestly, a lot of the movies that I have seen range from like a lot of French films, they don't have that same level of modesty or American modesty that most, you know, Western films have, Western cultured films such as American films. But I found a lot of those through the foreign, you know, market for movies. If there ever was one, though, however, I know if I was to say actress wise, Monica Bellucci, who is an incredible Italian or French actress, who has done movies like Irreversible. She also was in Brotherhood of the Wolves, which... they're not specifically sexually themed movies, but they have great scenes in them where Monica Bellucci is just amazing. But if I was to really kind of pinpoint it, as to one of those types of movies, it would be the director whom I've actually already previously mentioned, who did Birdman. Alfonso Cuarón did a movie back in 2001 called Y Tu Mama También, which has Maribel Verdú, where if you're not familiar with who Maribel Verdú is, she was, in more recent iterations, she was the mother to Barry Allen in the recent Flash film. She was also
great. He's terrible.
She was actually also the handmaid or the woman who took care of the house in Pan's Labyrinth. But she did a movie with Diego Luna and what's his name? Gael Garcia Bernal, I believe, when they were younger, about these young people who are learning about sexual discovery while with this older woman. And it was such an interesting movie, and it made me ask a lot of questions. And obviously at the time I couldn't really ask a lot of people, so I just continued to watch the movie over and over, understanding a lot of different perspectives. It didn't really end nicely, but it was still a great movie. And I think that's one of the ones that I feel like if I were ever to chalk it up to anything like that, that would be the movie I would probably raise that to that level. And it was very much about like adolescence, you know, sexual awakening, but at the same time, was it Gal? Why do I forget his name? He's the one who played the father to Miguel from Coco. Gal Garcia Bernal.
The grandfather?
Yeah, the one that who
Hector.
Is Hector, yeah.
Yeah, that's grandfather, not the father. I was like, that was...
Grandfather, I thought I said grandfather.
You said father. It's okay. Different people.
It's okay. But yeah. So wrapping up this movie, let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about whether or not the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let me start with Spencer.
Well, here we finally are at the end of this review.
Like you're giving a graduation commencement speech or something. So here we are.
Hey, done emotional with this. Whiplash. Emotional whiplash.
That's really what I'm just like hiding behind this whole review. Yeah, so this movie passes. Goodness. Like there's just a lot of feelings about this movie. There was a lot of sex, and it does make me question, like, you know, American society and sex and how it's very weirdly over-sexualized, but then also not. It's very odd, and, like, it's, will leave you, like, asking loads of questions about, you know, life, which is a good thing, I really feel like. Acting is great. There's interesting camera shots. Just, like, lots of good things in this movie. So don't let the large amounts of sex like dissuade you from this. I still think this movie is worth seeing. Maybe when you're in a good place and having a great time already, you just want to sit down and watch Emma Stone like have sex with like a whole bunch of people. So for me, this is like a 4.5 out of 5.
There you go. Ames.
This film passes for me. To say that it is a wild dream for a woman to be able to pursue whatever she wants without the societal pressures and expectations of the patriarchy, fantasy, you got it in this movie. But it also has a lot of heart and character, and the care that's taken in this film is met and felt in every frame, regardless of the lens that's used.
Mm-hmm.
As we stated, the performances are absolutely wonderful. And at the end of it all, the life that you choose to have and how you choose to lead it, I think is the best one that is meant for you, regardless of where your journey takes you. So for this, and yes, there's sex, I'm going to give this actually a 4.5 out of 5 monocles. I still like Book of Clarence a little better, I'm not going to lie.
Well, seeing as they're very different movies.
Yeah, but I gave that one.
I think
what,
that would have been a
8.
Very different experience if the Book of Clarence was anything like this. So. Yeah, so in terms of pass or fail, this movie passes for me. This was an absolute journey of self-exploration, autonomy and recognizing one's independence outside of the construct of just polite society. We are raised in a society where people frown upon certain things that are natural to explore within the human body. And after years and years of countless people who choose to hamper the conversations that would need to happen so that certain aspects don't outside of that happen, such as, you know, teen pregnancy, or, you know, if the conversations were to be a little bit more free flowing, as much as the violence in American movies, the machismo in American movies, the pushing of, you know, women are only for two things in film, that's to look pretty and to have sex, and that's it. Like, if we were to take that level back and keep the conversations of what sex is and how exploring who you are through whatever frame, whether if it's through your sexual exploration, your creativity, or the expansion of your mind, it's okay. And let's talk about it. I think the US, America's mindset would be a lot different nowadays.
100%.
In terms of the monocles for this film, I have to give it a 4.5 out of 5 as well. I really do feel like the performances in this movie were by far superb. However, Emma Stone really stole the show and gave us a performance that I don't think anybody will truly forget. And it isn't just because, as Amy had mentioned before we went on the air, of how weird Emma Stone's nipples look.
Wow, way to call me out and nipple shame.
But
rude.
Also for the fact that this movie really does, as Spencer said, give us an opportunity to create those conversations and get us thinking. So, yeah, I give it a 4.5 out of 5. And, yeah, I think that's all about it we can talk about. Don't shake your head at me.
But that about wraps it up.
That about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlossophers. Remember, you can catch us over on our website at filmlossophers.com. There we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, even sexual liberation movies.
Now with sexual liberation movies.
If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlossophers.com. You can also catch us on the social pages over at facebook.com/filmlossophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlossophy101. There you can also catch all of our great content, extra content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which we'll be probably doing one soon, maybe before 2025 comes.
That would be great, because I've unseen a lot of things, and we need to talk about it, but it's only available to be found on Instagram, and Instagram only, at Jane Unseen.
That's right. As well as that, you can also catch all of our great episodes wherever podcasts are streaming. And that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlossophers. Remember, it's The Filmlossophers. Give us a follow or subscribe on those platforms. Look for us there and let us know how you like the episode. Did you watch Poor Things? Did you not? Do you think Poor Things is going to sweep at the Oscars? Who knows? But let us know what you think in the comment section down below on those pages. And if you think we are doing a great job, give us a 5-star review, because we've earned that.
We have.
Yes, help Spencer. Give him that 5-star review.
Yeah, for all the work that Spencer put in, I would say, yeah, that definitely needs to happen. Spencer needs to have a better day. Give us a 5-star review for that. There you go.
For my mental health.
Emotional well-being.
Yes. So... But as I stated, thanks for listening in, and this was a great episode, so we will catch you next week. So from all of us here at the Filmlossophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm a changeable feast intern, Amy.
Class dismissed.